And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz here, Jordan and I on a little hiatus this week. Happy holidays to everybody. Hope you're enjoying the quality time. In lieu of a typical episode of Baseball Barbacast this week, we're going to give you kind of a supercut of all the greatest moments, best hits, top things that happened from this year in the Baseball Barbacast universe, our favorite guests, some of our favorite moments. We hope you enjoy. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season. We are honored to be joined by a guest with 3,154 more strikeouts than the two of us combined, Pedro Martinez, Hall of Famer. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, guys. It's an honor.
Of course. It's an honor to have you. I, you know, I'm sure people throw stats out for you all the time. Do you ever go back and look at your own stats?
You know what? I don't really look at my stats, but it shocks me to see how much stuff is brought up, especially nowadays with social media. Every once in a while, you know, I'm just checking my phone or whatever, going through Facebook and Instagram, and there's stuff. Someone has numbers and comparisons to other seasons and stuff like that. And it really shocks me to know that I did all that, because I never really stopped to look at how my career was going or what I was about to do. I was just about doing it right. But I wasn't really aware how time would later tell me about the things that I did.
Because when you're in it, you're just trying to win baseball games and get hitters out. And then you wake up 18 years later and you have a 2.93 in 2,800 innings. Pretty impressive.
Well, I'm watching now up close some of the guys that are doing stuff, incredible stuff, like Tarik Skubal. I've seen Verlander, Scherzer do things. Kershaw, most recently. And I get really glued into the TV and the numbers and stuff like that. But then, little you know, I'm in one of those boxes with every one of them that have done something really special. Yeah. And I just went, you know, all out when I wanted to do what I needed to do. But I never stopped to think that I will be in some of those boxes. And surprising to me, I get to see it now that I have enough time to kind of go through it.
Well, and it's really cool that you're really getting at something that we wanted to talk about with you, which is the current game, which, of course, you know, been working with TBS, you know, doing the pre and post game and talking about the best pitchers of today. And you kind of mentioned that experience of seeing what a Skubal or a Skeens or a Crochet is doing. And they might throw up and be like, first since Pedro Martinez. And you might have those moments like, wow, I must have been pretty good if this guy's throwing pretty well. So I must have been throwing pretty well. Have you had any? I guess you mentioned it seems like you have had some moments like that.
Yeah, I watch those guys and I don't get enough of them, especially, you know, their presence on the mound. When I see Tarik Skubal, when I see Paul Skeens, when I see Crochet, Jacob DeGrom, like I love Jacob DeGrom, his presence, his calm on the mound. Some guys just have that elite presence when they step on top of the mound. And I love to see that from the player, that sense of security.
Yeah. Can you learn that over time? Mm. Or is that just something guys have? You know, I think about Christopher Sanchez as an example, right? Where it was a very slow climb for him, where he didn't show up in the big leagues and was an ace. But now you watch him and he's in command. He's in control. He's confident. He's one of the best pitchers in the world. Is that something that you have, that dominant presence, that aggressiveness, or is that something that a player can learn over time?
I think you're born with the desire to be that guy, but you have to put a lot of time into it. And another guy that I'm going to give you that went from up on top, probably the best presence on the mound, to a guy that was shaky this year. And you guys are going to be shocked how much attention I pay to little things. Sandy Alcantara was reluctant to give the ball away, was probably the best pitcher for about 3 years where he would complete games. He was like out of place. The way the game is changing, Sandy Alcantara was out of place. We're a guy that was young, but had that mindset to go and finish what he started, which is something you weren't supposed to see at the time the game was changing towards probably what it is now. A lot of relievers, 5 or 6 innings, 0 complete games and stuff like that. But you learn to actually get comfortable on top of the mound. You learn how to become dominant on the mound, and it gives you the confidence to say, I am this guy on top of the mound. I'm this bully on top of the mound. And Paul Skenes is a rare breed of, you know, men and inside of, you know, of a uniform. And so is Tarik Skubal, Crochet. Those guys seem to have it from the first moment they stepped on the mound to this point of their career, where they are possible Cy Young, Rookie of the Year, a lot of success. Now, I hope I don't see it soon, but when they fail, I want to see when things don't go right, when things ache in your body, and you have to kind of get down and come back up. I would love to see how they respond to that, but not now, not anytime soon. I would love to see them cracking up some records that I have and everyone that have passed through the game.
But and we kind of saw that from Crochet the last 2 weeks, where he was great last night for his 7 scoreless. But the start before that, he got crushed at home against Cleveland, let up 4 home runs, 7 earned. And I remember like watching his face after letting up the 4th home run, and he couldn't believe it. Like, it didn't compute in his mind. He was like, I gave up 4 home runs. And then to see him go out there last night and throw, you know, 7 scoreless and strike out all those hitters, that's kind of what you're talking about, that, right, that bouncing back from failure.
Exactly. And if you don't have that in you, if you don't have the, you know, the ability to be a short-minded kind of person and put that stuff behind, you're going to struggle for a longer time. For special guys like those that we just mentioned, I think they have the ability to put it behind. And it's not how many times you fall, it's how many times you stand up after failure. It was the same way for me. I had a short memory for that. It was like, okay, you got me today. I wish I could be pitching against you 5 days later so I could go and get my revenge against you. That's competitiveness. And I think those guys all have it. And I would love to see them healthy and continue to do that. And I wish I could see more pitchers with the same attitude and the same confidence that they display on top of the mound. I love watching those guys. And actually, it's really interesting for me to be watching the race for the Cy Young. Watching Skubal go at it, he seems to have, like, you know, the far front lead on the other guys. But Crochet, especially after seeing what I saw last night, and don't put away Chapman. What Chapman is doing deserves a lot of looks from all of us, people in baseball, people that have interest in baseball, and the fans. I think what Chapman is doing is unbelievable. And in any other season where you had mediocre starting pitcher, Chapman would have been considered for the Cy Young. And that a lot of that probably has to see with the team. If the team was to put him in a place where he had a lot more saves and a lot more opportunities to save games, Chapman would have been in the Cy Young contention. Remember Clase? Clase was right there, down the wire with the Skubal. And I think Chapman probably had the same opportunity if the team was doing better or put him in place to save games.
So I'm glad you mentioned Chapman, and we just talked about Crochet a little bit. We did want to talk to you about this Red Sox season. obviously, as part of your job, clearly you are watching the whole league. It is not like you are just tuned into the Red Sox. That said, we know, you know, you have the Red Sox, of course, a special place in your career. And as you still continue to have that relationship with the franchise, this has been quite the season for them. They are in playoff position, but it has been rather dramatic. There have been a lot of moves. There have been a lot of great performances, disappointing performances. We've been joking all season, man, we should have had the Netflix documentary this year. Because, oh my goodness, has there been a lot happening compared to last season. But what is your take on this Red Sox season? They're in a good place. I think when you see them at their best, they look like a really good team. But there's a lot going on there. And with the Devers trade and everything, what has been your general big picture takeaway from this Red Sox season so far and where they could go from here?
Big picture, everything looks great. Devers seemed to be settled in San Francisco. The young kids that we brought up from the organization have done their job. They're making adjustments. I'm really quick to watch how they respond to adversity. Campbell is one example. How they deal with adversity. And for Cora and the rest of the guys, was a learning lesson this year. How to handle baseball stuff within baseball, within the clubhouse. For the entire organization, was a learning lesson. For Breslow, is a learning lesson. For me, is a learning lesson. For all of us that have never seen something like that, it's a learning lesson. It also gives you, the refreshing news to know that the talent is really all together, that all you need is kind of get comfortable, build that confidence while playing the game and believe that you are that guy. Like we were talking about the pitchers.
Yeah.
But those young players that the Red Sox have right now in the big leagues are showing that they are improving every single game that they play. They are gaining the confidence that we talk about. They are starting to feel that they belong where they are. As you know, it took Duran a little while to kind of feel confident enough to say, I am a superstar. I am a star of the game. I can go out there and play the way I know, and I'm going to be successful. So for the rest of the young players that are coming up and watching guys like Bregman, go out there and do what they do and how they go about their business, I think it's really important. Also, their catching. I think those two guys, Wong and Narvaez, have done an outstanding job at handling everything and adjusting. That a lot has to see with Jason being linked to those guys. I know Jason loves those guys. He doesn't stop working. The Red Sox were a learning lesson this year, but a positive one. I would say that.
We are delighted and overjoyed to be joined by a very special guest, a gentleman who played a handful of baseball games in his career. Cal Ripken Jr., thank you for joining us on the show.
Yeah, a handful of games. I guess the final number was 3,001, and I always laughed damn near all of them in a row.
I went back and, prepping to talk to you, I went back and watched some of the interviews you were doing around the time of 2131, and, something that made me laugh was when Chris Berman asked you on the day if you thought you were going to be in the lineup. Do you remember this?
Yeah. I had that. There was a couple other similar kind of asked. Yeah. Am I going to have somebody cut up my food on the days leading up to it so I don't have a knife accident? So anyway. What was another one? It might have been People Magazine at the time. Asked me if there was something about soap on a rope so that you wouldn't slip on soap in the shower.
Oh, so no shower injuries.
Yeah, the ultimate bubble wrap situation. Like, we got to make sure you're making it to that special
for
day.
For sure.
So for those of you listening who are not enormous Orioles fans, we are coming up on the anniversary of 2131, the all-time record for consecutive games played that Cal broke in 1995. And so just very quickly, Cal, my story with this is I was born the day before
9/5/95, September 5th, 1995. My whole mom's side of the family is from Baltimore. And my grandmother left my mother in the hospital to go to the game. She had tickets. And she said, I have grandkids. I will have more. But I have season tickets. And I have lived in Baltimore my whole life. And I'm not missing this. And I was born at like 5:45 p.m. And there's a picture of me like in front of the TV as you're looking at 2130. And my question for you is like, I'm sure you've heard many stories like this over the years, right? The way that people connect to what you accomplished. Are there any of them that stand out where you're like, wow, that is a great little tale. That is a great nugget of how 2130, 2131 connected with someone.
I wish I had one really great story, but a lot of them are similar to what you're describing right now. Yeah. Is that September 6th, they were born on September 6th, and people took great pride that they were born and either had the game on in the hospital or kept going out, looking at it, and coming back. So I've met a lot of people. It's been a long time now. It's the 30th year anniversary. So, it is a great pride that people take that were born either on September 5th or September 6th. I joke with Eddie all the time is that Eddie hit his 500th home run on September 6th, 1996. So every time it comes up, I send him happy anniversary. And he says, yeah, you had to overshadow my 500th home run.
Very selfish.
But, you know, I don't know. I guess you get philosophical in your old age. You try to figure out why it was so important to a lot of people. And I think that people really relate to loving something and showing up for it every day. You know, I wasn't one that had a perfect attendance in school. Matter of fact, I think my parents, and sometimes I believe that you needed a day or two to get back on track sometimes, where you would stay home and you really weren't sick, but you stayed home so you could catch up. But many people went to work for 30 years or 35 years or 40 years in an assembly line. Or my favorite one was Ernie Tyler. The Tylers around Baltimore. Ernie Tyler was the umpire attendant. And he didn't miss a game for 31 years, come to the ballpark every day. And he broke his streak when on my induction ceremony in 2007. So I just think it's interesting. I've enjoyed hearing people's stories about that. So it must be a value. It must be a principle that we all care about and that we relate to. You might not be able to relate to somebody throwing 100 or somebody that can hit a baseball and hit 100. You certainly can relate to an attitude or persistence or perseverance that you do in your own lives.
Yeah. I think that the thing that I was really curious about, because now as we come up on the anniversary and there'll be so much celebrating that specific day and how that day went, and we're going to get into that with you too, but I want to talk about the years leading up to it, because for me, you know, looking back on it, it's not like you woke up that day on September 6th and you're like, oh my God, I'm about to set this record. Wow. Where did this come from? You know, but at some point, like at what point did this become a thing? Because that's a long time to be building up to it. Obviously, going into that season in 95, it was very much in everyone's people's minds. But how many games did you have to play in a row before people actually really did take notice?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I can give you a sort of a timeline. I got to the big leagues, just before my 21st birthday. I turned 21 later that month. I got called up. I played every day in my rookie year. Became the rookie of the year, played every day in my second year. We won the World Series. So rookie of the year, and I won the MVP, and we won the World Series in the first 2 years. And so I was just learning to play the position, learning how to, what my potential could be. So you kept going out there and playing, and the managers just kept writing my name in the lineup, and I was responding. And I would guess about 800 or 900 games, people started to take notice of it. I mean, I guess that's, 5 years worth? And during that time frame, I think during that 5-year period, I played in every inning of every game.
Yeah.
But never gave it a thought. Nobody ever thought about, is this thing good? Is this thing bad? Is it harmful to them? I was just going out and playing, and the managers wrote my name in the lineup. It wasn't until we got close to the National League record, they started taking notice of it. And then, Everett Scott was like 1306, And then so he was second to Lou Gehrig. Lou Gehrig's number was so far in advance that nobody really thought about it. But the Orioles went into a rebuilding mode, you know, in and around that time frame. A lot of challenges. Every time it seemed like I went into a slump or the team wasn't playing well, there was sort of a negative feeling towards the streak. That Cal should take a day off. He's being selfish. All he cares about is himself. He should, for the sake of the team. But all I did was show up with the same attitude that I did when we were winning in those times, yeah. And saying, you know, you want to play. And the manager has to sit in his office and decide who can meet the challenge of the day, and they write your name in the lineup. So I never believed in it. Sometimes I kind of resent the fact that you had to defend yourself, that you wanted to play. Because there's some people that, you know, if they didn't want to face the pitcher that was pitching that particular night, you know, he's very tough on them, they might come up with a mysterious illness or a injury like a day or two before, so they don't have to face that person. I always thought that that person should have to defend himself, why totally. He wasn't playing. And so, but then it got to a point probably around 1,600 or 1,700 games, maybe 1,800, where everybody turned positive. All my critics turned, they jumped on the side and said, this is the greatest thing for baseball. Cal's got to break this record. There was collective bargaining issues and labor issues
right,
around that time. And I think that that everybody thought it would be good for baseball if we focused on that at the time. So it was all happy. And then even after the record was broken in 1995, I continued playing 500 more games after that. And we were really good in 96 and 97. And if there was one moment that I think I was selfish in the whole streak thing, it was in 97. I herniated a disc in my back in July. And I'm thinking, we're the best team in the league from the opening day till now, and I'm not going to miss out on this. So I asked the doctor, I said, look, if I can get through the pain, would I do any permanent damage to myself? And he said, no, I don't think you will. So I gave it a try. I wasn't going to miss out on being on a good team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's funny that there was criticism in like 1991. You guys win 67 games. The difference in you taking a day off and not taking a day off is not going to transform the 1991 Orioles into like this perennial, this contending ball club. So I think that dynamic is really interesting. I want to zoom in on September 6, 1995 for a second, because one of my favorite nuggets from the story is you taking your daughter to kindergarten, right?
Yeah.
Because I think your appeal and why people gravitated towards what you accomplished was in large part because it was very relatable, right? It was, you went to work every day. And here you are on the morning where you are the most famous person in America on that day, doing the most normal human thing that someone can possibly do, drop their kid off for their very first day of school. So my question for you is, what do you remember about that specific interaction of getting in the car in the morning, driving to the school, dropping her off, and driving home?
It's amazing is that just came up with my daughter about a week ago. She was trying to figure out a way to come back. She's got a pretty demanding job out in Colorado. And she was saying, Dad, I can't make it back for the 4-hour anniversary, she used to call it. And then I said, it's kind of cool looking back on September 6th and breaking the record and all that. She goes, I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about my 30th anniversary of you taking me to school, my first day of school. And I remember I was pretty exhausted during that time. It was like there was a lead up. There was a finish line. There was giving extra time as best you could.
You're not sleeping much.
And I had a little bit of a fever. I was not feeling really well. So you're not sleeping really well. But it was really important to get up and take your daughter to a first day of school. And I'm glad she remembers it that way. I'm glad that she looks back on it. It was our time. I got some ink in the paper, and she got a mention, which she never really liked the attention that the name brought to her. But in this particular case, she was proud of it. So
did you take her into the school, or did you drop her off in front? Like, were there people swarming your car? Like, what was that environment like?
No, early on, the first day of school, you want to make sure you haven't really got the carpool thing down at her school.
You had never done carpool. This was your first carpool experience as a dad.
I did walk her in, you know, just to make sure everything was all right. And she was good, that she felt good, but she's always really independent. So that was a really cool thing. And I do remember there were some times when she asked me and during carpool, whether I could pick her up like down there a little bit or up there, because I was getting attention in carpool line.
But, can you imagine your daughter's
most part, for the most part,
being your daughter's kindergarten teacher and like you walk in on September 6th night, like you're like, oh, this girl Rachel is on the list and like she could be a good, and you just walk into the room. It's like mind blowing.
So she was all girls school, and we were in the news a lot. So, I mean, it was definitely a big deal. But I remember things like this, like I would pull up to pick her up sometimes in the carpool, and I'd open up the sunroof window, and I'd stand on the seat and yell Rachel across the way so that all her friends would see her. And then she goes, Dad, Dad, you know, and I took great fun and pride in doing that, just normal fun things like that.
Are now thrilled to be joined by a very special guest. He is having a pretty decent season. His name is Jacob Wilson of the A's. Jacob, welcome to Baseball Barbercast.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
So there are a lot of different places we could begin with you. You're having, like Jordan said, a phenomenal rookie season, a very unique rookie season. I want to begin with your stance. I know you get a lot of questions about this. You're pretty active in the batter's box. I went back and looked at some video of you from the Northwoods from college, and it seems like you've gotten almost noisier over time. Can you kind of explain how that's been the case?
Yeah, I've kind of always been that twitchy athlete ever since I was a kid. I've always kind of been moving the box ever since I was, you know, very young. You know, that's kind of something my dad always taught me. I kind of learned that the more movement I had, I kind of, it was better for me in the box, you know, face these pitches. I was never a good athlete that could just stand still and be explosive. I always had to like kind of move in rhythm and being, it's all kind of timing based, you know, rhythm goes into the timing and then timing goes into the swing. And then, it's not something I've always been doing, like I said, since I was a kid. And, you know, as you kind of develop and go from high school to college to pro ball, you know, the pitches just keep getting better and better. So I think that, you know, over time, it always kind of started to get a little bit faster and faster because I kind of just had to, you know, be more in rhythm to face these guys on a daily basis. So I think it's gotten faster, and it's always just been a twitchy swing.
And are you doing drill work with that type of movement? Like when you do T stuff or you do flips?
It's still twitchy, but it's not as fast. You know, when I'm in the cage, like it's kind of just feeling out the swing and feeling out the stance. But, you know, in game is definitely when it's at its fastest for sure.
I think what I'm curious about, you mentioned that development and the pitchers getting better and better, and that may be impacting your move in the box. I'm also curious about kind of the timing of your development, because your high school senior year was 2020, and that, of course, I'm sure complicated things as you transition into college and you know, not having that, maybe that full senior season. But, you know, the strikeouts and that's it. Oh, he hasn't struck out and all these things. Like that seems to have only gotten better as you've gone up different levels. You know, you struck out more than you walked as a freshman at Grand Canyon. But then obviously since then, it has been a lot more extreme towards making as much contact as basically anyone else in baseball. Yeah. So when did you kind of realize you had that knack of putting the bat on the ball?
Yeah, it definitely goes back to kind of high school. You know, I definitely never liked striking out. That's just something my dad built into me. He didn't like striking out. So for me, it was always, you know, put the ball in play, you know, good things can happen, you know, defense makes an error, it's like a two strike swinging bunt, you know, whatever happens. But, you know, any way to find a way on base was kind of my dad's main kind of lesson to me growing up, is just put the ball in play and, you know, good things can happen for your team. So going into my freshman year, obviously, like you said, struck out a little bit more than I wanted to, and kind of really worked on a two strike approach that year. I think in high school, you know, you don't really have to have a crazy two strike approach because you're not really facing too many arms that are crazy overpowering. But once you get to college, it starts getting a little bit harder. So after my freshman year, I really built in a two-strike approach and just kind of building the mentality of like, you know, I'm going to go out there and this guy's not striking me out. I'm going to do whatever I can for this guy not to strike me out, you know, fouling off his best pitches and just waiting for them to make a mistake. So, you know, for me, it's always been kind of a mindset and on top of an approach based two strike thing to really just put the ball in play. And, you know, like I said, that's kind of the main lesson my dad taught me growing up, put the ball in play and go things to happen.
So you say that you know, growing up, you didn't like to strike out. Do your strikeouts, because you have so few of them, stick in your brain? Like, I went back and watched today the five strikeouts you had your junior year. Do you like remember those moments almost as much as you remember the doubles and the home runs?
Yeah, I you know, talking about those five strikeouts, I think I remember all five from that junior year of college. It definitely, you know, it stings a lot when you strike out as a hitter, but then on top of that, when you're known for not striking out, I think it kind of hurts a little bit more, you know, to me. But you can't let that affect, you know, your next at bat. You know, if you strike out the first at bat of the game, you still got, you know, 3-4 more at bats. So I try to let it go as quick as possible, but for you know, some time, it definitely does sting, but I try to throw it away real quick.
And I would imagine, like, when that happens, you know, I have all the videos up in front of me, like, you strike out against Texas State, and I imagine the entire opposing dugout is just hooting and hollering as you're walking back to the dugout, right? It's like a little bit louder.
I remember some dugouts to get pretty loud when I struck out. I was just like, oh, well, you know, you just got to tip your cap. Pitchers make good pitches. So, you know, tip your cap and try to get him next at bat.
Bro, they don't boo nobodies, you know?
I'm curious, because you're still striking out at a rate lower than, you know, almost anyone else in the major leagues. But of course, it's, you know, more than five. As those pitchers, of course, you're still having plenty of success. But it feels a little unfair to stick on the strikeouts here. But I'm curious your perspective, because it happens so infrequently. I'm curious, like, at this level, you know, when you're in college, sometimes you might get rung up on a bad pitch. Maybe you swing and miss here and there. But for the most part, a lot of your strikeouts might be having to do with some umpiring more. Whereas in the big leagues, you know, you're going to have situations where, as you just said, like, a good pitch is a good pitch. At the highest level, what are the good pitches that are so much better than you've really ever seen before? Again, clearly you're still having a lot of success, but what are some of the pitches that you've seen at the major league level that are just, like, different? I know you just faced Tarek Skubal. That's a good example, but who are some pitches that, or specific kinds of pitches that stand out at the highest level?
Yeah, I think kind of all of them, in a sense. You know, every pitcher kind of has their go-to pitch that they have, whether they have a really good vert fastball or they have a really good slider that breaks later, a changeup, whatever it may be. But I think the main thing kind of in the big leagues is that pitchers will make their pitches look like strikes longer, and then at the last second they'll end up being balls. So I think that's kind of the hardest thing you have to learn, you know, when you first get here, is just looking for these pitches. I think they tunnel them very well, you know. In the minor leagues, you know, balls usually are, you can see balls out of the hand, and here they'll throw pitches that look like a slider down away for a strike, and then they'll break off 3 feet. And, you know, it's just a good pitch. You know, yesterday we faced Skubal, and you kind of go out there, you're like, all right, you just got to battle this guy, you know, try to foul off his best pitches and wait for something in the zone. And, you know, like you said, he's kind of been unbelievable these past 2 years, and it's definitely a tough at bat for sure. But, you know, like I said, you just go up there and you really just try to battle them off. I think yesterday I swung at a changeup that I almost bounced, and I somehow just barely nicked it. And you kind of just like, all right, got lucky there, got to lock in more against those guys, especially when you go up against those Cy Young winners.
And I think that's something fans don't totally understand all the time, is like, so much of pitching in the big leagues is making balls look like strikes and making strikes look like balls. Like, you had I think it was against Zach Wheeler, right? You had like that front hip slider.
Yes.
That looked like a ball for 25 minutes until the very last second.
And it comes right? in, last second. Yeah. Those are the pitches that it's hard to lay off. There's the ones that look balls forever and then look like strikes, and the ones that look like strikes forever and then end up being balls.
So then, like, for you, someone who's swinging more often than a lot of players, what would you define as a good pitch to hit?
Yeah, I think, honestly, for me, I just go up there and I just kind of look for a strike in the heart of the zone. I know that with me, I don't have the power to, you know, hit a homer right or hit a homer center. Like, for me, it's looking for something that I could drive left center and over down the left field line. So, a good pitch for me would be going up there and looking for something in the heart of the zone and just being on time to hit it. And, you know, these guys don't make mistakes too often, but you definitely, you know, everybody's human. So you just got to look for those mistakes that they leave in the middle of the plate here and there.
And I think it's clear you understand your strengths. And it is interesting because, you know, I've had conversations with guys like Stephen Kwan about this, where, you know, having this ability to put the bat on the ball is, of course, a gift. But sometimes it kind of puts you in positions where maybe you might get yourself out because you're able to put the bat on balls that maybe you aren't necessarily going to. So how have you kind of struck that balance so far? As I said many times, like, you're clearly having success. But what has that kind of challenge been like when you know you can make contact with more pitches than maybe you should be?
Yeah, no, it is definitely, that is something that, you know, as a contact hitter, you got to learn to do. You know, these pitches that, you know, you'll swing at a ball that's like down and away that you'll hit off into the bat to the first baseman, and you're like, or to the pitcher, and you're like, man, I just would have swung and missed there. Then I could have an extra couple pitches to go up there and really just have an at bat, you know. So for me, it's starting to learn that it's okay to swing and miss, you know, in certain situations, and just not being able to, you know, a 2-0 count, if they throw a slider and you swing and miss by 4 feet, like, so what? You know, as long, at least you didn't, you know, hit it off the end of the bat to the first baseman or chop it back to the pitcher. You know, it's okay to swing and miss in those in certain spots. And then obviously with two strikes, kind of just fouling everything off and just waiting for a pitch to, you know, put in play. But no, like you said, I think, you know, we just played against, you know, Steven last week, and, you know, he goes up there and he hits everything. And it's super impressive to kind of be on the other side of the field and watch it. And, you know, he's just, you know, obviously a great hitter and a contact guy, like you said. And, you know, that's definitely, you know, something as a contact hitter, you got to be able to lay off those pitches that are, you know, out of the zone and not and kind of, you know, hit them softly and play.
All right, Lucas, thank you for joining us. Lucas Giolito is admittedly cooked. We are absolutely ecstatic to have you back on the show. Your first appearance on this stupid podcast was way back in April of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
It has been over a decade. We've had you on in the time since. A lot has happened in our lives. A lot has happened in your life. A lot has happened in the world. But the one question I think we need to start with is, what team are you going to sign with, Lucas?
No idea. That's a crazy question to ask. And it hasn't even been winter meetings yet.
All right. Well, I'm glad we're on the same page.
All right.
Cool. Because I also have no idea. And instead of probing any further and trying to get you to reveal any confidential information.
Can you imagine, though? Wait, can you imagine if I asked that and you're like, the freaking Reds, dude? And we were like,
yeah. He's like, I'm so glad you asked. I just found out.
That'd be cool. No, I have no idea. I still don't. I don't know anything yet, honestly.
Okay. All right. That's a good place to start, because part of this conversation is to kind of give some people a lens into the experience of being a free agent as a Major League Baseball player, because we can make fun of you for being unemployed, but this is not exactly the situation. Your resume is whatever baseball website of choice, whether that is, you know, your Baseball Reference, your Fangraphs, Baseball Savant, and so on. But we kind of were curious about this. This is not the first time you've gone through free agency, so you kind of know a little bit what to expect. Mm-hmm. But here's one way to frame it. You kind of already got to it that, like, you have no idea, nothing's started yet. But as you reflect back on your first time through free agency, you got to give people a lens into what this experience is like. How many days a week, you know, during the offseason when you're a free agent, are you, like, actively doing things related to free agency? Whether that's communicating with your agent, whether that's meeting with teams, whether that's, I mean, I guess, you know, working out,
like, calling someone you know who lives in a place. Like,
yeah.
How many days a week are you doing free agency actively?
It's not so, like, rigid like that. It's more fluid. I think it can go so many different directions. Like, I know I've played with guys where they had their agent, but, like, they almost would go over their agent and, like, do their own contract and, like, their own thing. I have no desire to do that. You know, you guys know I'm with Ryan. I've been with him since I was a teenager, more so than him just being my agent. He's also one of my best friends. And so I put my full trust into him and, like, CAA and everything they're doing. I don't get involved in any way whatsoever. I let them do their job, talking to the front offices and setting up meetings. And then when it's time for me to have a Zoom meeting or meet a manager or pitching coach for lunch or whatever that may be, then I'm ready for that. But as far as like my off season, it's like the same as any other off season when it comes to like the like work and preparation for the season.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know where that season's going to be yet.
When you do the Zoom calls, like, what do you wear? Like, you just like, you would wear something a little nicer than that, or you would.
No, it depends on the timing. Like, we're doing this podcast in the morning. I'm going to go work out after this. So I'm wearing my workout clothes. If I had a Zoom call with like the Detroit Tigers or the Rakuten Monkeys, or you know, the Seoul Swallows, whatever.
Yeah. That's a team for sure.
I would probably just wear whatever.
Okay. You wouldn't suit up like a job interview?
No, I don't, because it's not a traditional job interview. It's so different. It's so different.
Is it more like a first date than a job interview?
It's like the team is pitching you.
Right. It's like it goes both ways. It goes both ways, right? You obviously want to be impressive, but they are also trying to make you feel like that's somewhere where you would want to go.
Yes.
So it's going both ways. That's why you're kind of interviewing each other. And I think that's kind of what Jake's getting at. Was that something that you kind of learned last time when you went through this?
Yeah. I mean, I think I only had like one Zoom call, and that was with the Red Sox. And I had like one lunch with another team. My free agency.
Who paid?
Oh, God. I'm pretty sure that they paid.
They paid.
And both were very nice. Good conversation. My thing is like, when I go into this thing, I don't want to like suit up because that's not my personality, you know? I want to be myself.
That'd be so misleading.
Like, if I were to, you know, if I'm talking to the manager, I'm talking to the GM, I'm talking to the pitching staff, like, I want to be myself. And then if you like me for myself, great. It might be a good fit. You know.
So that sounds like a first date.
I guess
that part of it. Right?
Maybe there's some of that type of vibe in there. But to me, it's more like it's a pitch meeting. Like they're pitching you and you're just kind of like taking it all in and asking questions, you know?
Is it fun being a free agent? Like, I know this is your second time. Like, do you enjoy it? Is it cool having people be like, you're great, we love everything about you, versus say like arbitration where it's like, you suck. Like, like we don't want to pay you anything.
I think you're going to get different answers based on who you're asking.
Yeah.
Like if you ask Dylan Cease if free agency is fun, I'm sure he's going to say, yeah, it was a blast. I made over $200 million.
And I was done by Thanksgiving.
And it was
right?
like yeah, I'm sure that in his case, it was like, Toronto was interested early and they went and were like, all right, this is our number. And Toronto was probably like, all right, we see your number. Here's our number. It's our final offer. We're going to pull it in 10 days. And they took it because it's a load of money, right? That's my assumption. I didn't talk to him. Right. I have no idea how his free agency went. My free agency, my first one, didn't go like that at all. I down my leg the last 2 months of the season and ruined my numbers. So my value
playing for five different teams.
Yeah. So my value completely tanked going into free agency. I was lucky enough to get with the Red Sox and you know, I really loved and cherished my experience there, despite the fact that as soon as I got there, I blew my elbow out. So that sucked. But then last year had a really, really fun time and it was great. And we made the playoffs and then I got hurt again. And it was like the worst thing that could have ever happened.
So I hate to bring up sad times, but I do want to ask you about that because I saw you. Mm-hmm. During that time and like in that moment, right? Like it's raw both physically and emotionally.
Yeah.
But like when you look back on that, like how do you take in that experience of watching the team that you had spent the whole year with compete in the biggest games of the season, and you're just like this helpless husk, like sitting there as a spectator?
Yeah, it brought me like directly back to the year prior, right? When I was rehabbing my elbow. The rehab was tough. You know, it was way tougher than my first Tommy John. You know, I'm also a lot older. So I go through that, and it's like finally when I get the chance to play again and do what I love to do, I was really, really trying to cherish it. You know, I came out of the gate kind of screwed up, and then we fixed it, and then I pitched very well. And there was a lot of fun, you know, being in that rotation and being able to follow up Crochet and how special of a season he was having. And it was a ton of fun. And then it's like, all right, cool, we're like going to make the playoffs. And then September, especially the last couple weeks of September, it was like, oh boy, this does not feel good. And it just brought me directly back to the year prior, which I thought was in the rearview mirror. You know, I'm like, all right, cool, we're past this. Everything's good now. Whether I pitch well or pitch poorly, like at least I'm healthy and pitching and contributing. And then it was just like ripped from me right at the end. You know, it was terrible. And you know what the craziest part about it is I'm completely fine now. Like I was yesterday I was playing catch at 180 feet and spinning breaking balls, and I feel great. I'm getting really good work done. So it's like, it did was take me out of pitching in the playoffs and screw over my free agency. That's all that happened.
from an optics side. Now it's a little bit different than, you know, multiple months of poor performance. And that's the other thing, as we kind of reflect on the differences between round two of free agency for you and last time. You did, I imagine, still feel better about what you were able to do this year compared to what you were able to do last year, you know, sour ending aside. I think is that fair to say?
You're coming off, like, you feel better about your walk here now than you did the last time around.
I do, but I still have this kind of bitter taste in my mouth from the end of it. And you know, not being able to go in the playoffs is like inexcusable in my book. It's just, unfortunately, my elbow was stuck. Like, well, you can't see in the camera, but my elbow was stuck. I couldn't move it very much. It's like, how am I going to go and throw a baseball right now? So, I don't know. I wish we had made it further. I wish, you know, we had somehow managed to win that game three and make it further, because I think I could have rehabbed back and been ready at some point if we kept climbing up through the playoffs. But
do you watch the playoffs after you get knocked out?
Yeah, I watched.
Or is it just like,
I watched.
Okay. Because some guys, it's just like, I don't want to engage with this.
Yeah, like, no, I watched. I thought it was a very exciting playoffs, especially the World Series. It was really cool.
What a treat it is to be joined by one of our favorite voices in the game. And if you're watching on YouTube, you get to see his lovely face as well. It's Brian Anderson, broadcaster for the Milwaukee Brewers and many other things. But Brian, we're going to talk about the Milwaukee Brewers today. Welcome to Baseball Barbercast.
Oh, man. What an honor to be here. Can't wait to get this started.
When did you first start to get recognized for your voice? Like, how, when in your career did that happen? No, get out of here. Get out of here. Like, in Milwaukee, if you walk in somewhere and you like order a coffee, is the barista ever like,
No, here's the actual interaction that happens most often. Oh, you sound like the guy from the Brewers. Yeah. I'm Brian Anderson. Oh, you seem so much taller on television.
Ooh.
Short Kings, man.
They say that about Caleb Durbin too.
That's right.
Yeah, that's
I am the president of the Short Kings Brewers, who are dominating Major League Baseball.
No, that's true.
I think the CC Sabathia years were, that was when kind of, You know, I used to get called Matt Mascurgia a lot because he was the announcer in Milwaukee. Two announcers prior to me, it was Matt Mascurgia and Darren Sutton, and then me. So I still get things shouted at me like, "Hey, Craig Kishon," or "Hey, Matt Mascurgia." So like, it's all good.
Well, here's the thing, Brian. You have been doing this in Milwaukee for a long time, and yeah. I think you are qualified, not just because it is still your job and you get to call Brewers games all the time, but you have seen this Brewers experience in several different iterations. If I'm not mistaken, your first season there was 2007. Is that yep. correct?
That's right.
Okay. So, and you know, since 2007, the Brewers have been one of the most successful teams in Major League Baseball, at least in the regular season. We know that in the postseason, it has not been quite as successful, but you have seen a lot of very, very compelling, fun, lot of wins in the regular season. That has happened many times before. But this season feels a little bit different, and we have no idea what's going to happen in October. But as someone who has watched many runs to the playoffs for Milwaukee, what does feel meaningfully different about this run?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been asked that a lot about, you know, this is my 19th year with the Brewers. And prior to that, I was with the San Antonio Spurs. So I've been really lucky to have been a part of, you know, winning franchises. The Spurs won four titles, four of their five, while I was there as their sideline reporter and working in that organization. Then I came to the Brewers. And pretty much every year I've been here since 07, they have been competitive. So it's usually come down to September, even the years they didn't make it, the Ken Maka years as manager, they were still competitive in September. They were still in a pennant race. But this team, I've never seen anything like this team. I don't know what the postseason's going to look like. That is to be determined. You know, there are a lot of guys on this team that haven't been in a postseason scenario. You know, I think they're going to be good, but it's all about who gets hot. So I want to keep that capsule in the regular season, but I've never seen anything like this from a Brewers team. Even the CC Sabathia run that I mentioned a moment ago, there was a lot of stress in that season. That was my second year. And, you know, those who know the Brewers well know that they weren't even in the postseason until the very last day. They had a chance at a tiebreaker, but only because the Mets collapsed did the Brewers even make it in that year. So, as a wild card, this is the old format when the wild card went into a division series. So, yes, Sabathia was amazing and revisionist history and all of that should be a documentary. But that wasn't special like this. I mean, they just won 40 out of 50 games. And it's been an amazing ride to see with a you know, the land of the misfit toys and guys that nobody really knew. Certainly, we had to do our homework as the local broadcasters. Figuring out who these players are, how they fit, what most of them are platoon type players, but you know, they
which
just hit
one
on
of them is Isaac Collins,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he's the one at third base one? Today or second base. Oh, he's gonna be maybe the rookie of the year is the left fielder. I don't think that was on the bingo card at spring training.
Oh, it's so, like it's 10, so good, 10 different absurd rookie seasons to kind of sort through, I would say. Like for all different reasons, from Mizorowski to Durbin to Collins to Henderson to Chad Patrick's. It's like on and on and on. You just don't know what's happening. And then, oh, here's Andrew Vaughn. It's Barry Bonds. All right, great. Now we have this. You say, Brian, you say this. I haven't seen this. And you can refer to just like the winning speaks for itself, the record, the stretch over these last couple months. But when you say this, what are we talking? Is it just the combinations of the players? Is it the fact that these players had low expectations and low track records? Is it just Pat Murphy? Is it, we are obviously going to ask you about Bob Uecker and just what he has meant, of course, posthumously to this season and what he already meant so much to this city. Give us a little bit more specifics about what this means.
Yeah, there's definitely the Uecker magic part of this. There's no question. I mean, I think you know, from a spiritual standpoint, he's always with us and he's going to always be a big part of Brewers baseball. He was the spine of Brewers baseball for so many years. So there is that piece, but that's also the galvanizing piece as well. And a lot of these players didn't know him that well, but they knew him well enough because Uecker's always in the clubhouse. So even the younger players I remember Vin Scully at the end of his career, you know, he didn't just wasn't in the best health to go down to the clubhouse. He didn't go downstairs very often. So the players, while they heard Vin Scully, didn't know Vin Scully. That was not the case with Bob Uecker. He had a locker in the clubhouse. Like, he was down there every single day. So that piece still exists in a significant way. I would say I think the biggest part of this, and that's a really good question, Jordan, because what I feel and what I mean by that specifically is it's all of those things you mentioned and more. And I think big picture, if you want to pull out a little bit further, I think the Brewers are changing the game. So there are teams that have changed the game. Obviously, players in the NBA, Stephen Curry changed the game, the three-point revolution. I think the Brewers, and I don't know if it's going to carry on to the rest of baseball, it will certainly be the case in Milwaukee, because this is going to have to be how they play and perform and build rosters. But they're bringing baseball back the way I know it. And that means playing to win, playing to compete in every at bat. And it gets a little touchy, and the analytics crowd comes at me a little bit, because I'm not saying analytics don't have a place. They do. Building rosters, putting the players together that fit or they think can fit, the versatility, all of that plays. But once you get in the room, then it's about the heartbeats and how can you get the most out of those players. So Pat Murphy, coaching staff, very good at that. Players are very good at that. The veteran guys, the Rhys Hoskins, Christian Yelich, you know, 30 years ago, you were a rookie into a clubhouse. You felt like you were unwanted. You were unwelcome. That's not the case now. And I think those guys deserve a lot of that credit. So there's a style of play. It's not incentivized yet financially, but you got to remember the makeup of the Brewers are players who are trying to stay in the big leagues. So that's the incentive. So players who are trying to stay in the big leagues, that is the incentive to play this way. And that is doing all those little things that make baseball great. As I said, I think the Brewers are hopefully going to be the team that breaks the three true outcomes era of Major League Baseball. And I know that's going to be the case in Milwaukee, and that's going to be how they function moving forward. And I do think that it does play. Now, we'll see how it plays in the playoffs, because a team that plays hard and plays to win every at-bat and every sequence, that you lose that edge in the postseason, because every 100% team does that. And so that's my, you know, my biggest concern.
The offseason rolls on. We move forward. 2025 is in the ground.
Close it's the over. Book.
Close that
Close
book,
the
folks.
Lid on the Dodgers, time capsule.
We don't care anymore. We move forward. We move forward.
I'm closing the book, Jordan.
Okay. Jake's closing the book. We are all done. Thank you all for listening to Baseball Barbecast, Time Capsule 6th Annual. And we will talk to you all next week, where we look forward. Goodbye.
We open a new book.